Our next presenter is Cy Gart, and he's another longtime member and participant in the ASA. I just have to tell you this brief story about Cy. I met him, I think, for the first time Thursday night at the roundtable dinner, and I had to tell him the extreme coincidence of several things coming together. Before I even looked at the abstracts for the talks that I was moderating, I had been reading an article by him because colleagues in my department have chosen a reading packet for the senior seminar that I'll be teaching in a couple of weeks here. And one of Cy's articles was one of those in the packet. And it was on the extended evolutionary synthesis. I don't think he's going to address that particularly today. But I read that article with much gusto and found it to be very insightful. Today he's speaking on evolution, the more intelligent design. So I think we're in for a treat in this one. And since we're all here, I don't think it hurts if we start a couple of minutes early. So Cy, why don't you go ahead? Thank you.
Well, I guess since I'm the last speaker, we can go a little late too, right?
Well, now I was going to say that that's not an option because there's lunch coming up.
But oh, lunch, okay.
You can forget certainly it. Corner him and talk to him on the way to lunch.
Don't keep people from lunch. First, I'd like to really thank the first two speakers, Seth and Larry, because everything they said was a great introduction to what I'm going to say. It probably won't allow me to skip some stuff, but it helps because, as you can see from the title, I'm going to talk about design and evolution, those two things. And I don't think of them, as I think both of the previous speakers indicated, as opposite options, but as Larry said, you know, both. So I think that almost everyone, Christians, atheists, everyone agrees that life is designed. Richard Dawkins uses the word appearance of, but certainly he admits that there's a beautiful design in all life. And just to give a few examples, if we look at some aspects of life, flowers, fish, birds, animals, and of course human beings, and I carefully selected that example. without doubt designs, both structurally and functionally, that are remarkable and cannot be denied. But there is an assumption, and we heard that assumption in Larry's talk when he quoted the NASA definition of life. The assumption that we have there is that life includes evolution, includes Darwinian evolution by natural selection. So it almost sounds like as soon as we have life, it evolves. And that could be true, I don't know, but what it's ignoring, what the assumption is it's ignoring the fact that evolution is actually, and it depends on an extremely complex biochemical process, without which there is no evolution. Some of that process was shown in one of Larry's slides, which is the translation of genotype, which is inherited. Actually, let me show some slides here. Biological evolution actually does not automatically arise from proto-life or early life forms. You can imagine a proto-cell that doesn't have DNA or RNA or anything else. It just has metabolism, and it doesn't evolve. That's possible. And what I said before, it requires complex, finely tuned, and especially, and I'll stress this a lot, accurate biochemical mechanisms, and the accuracy has to do with DNA replication, which is one of these processes, the transcription of information from DNA to RNA so it can get into the cell, and the translation of that information from nucleotide to amino acid chemistry, which is not easy to do for a chemist, in the ribosome. And all of these processes must be far greater than 99% accurate. If they're not, no evolution. And in fact, to repeat this, the central mechanism of evolution is the genotype is inherited. That's how you get natural selection. If a bird gets a better eyesight but doesn't pass it on, there's no evolution. So you have to have accurate transmission of changes in the genotype. But the genotype is not selected for. The phenotype is the target of natural selection. So you have to have a translation from the genotype, which is changed and passed on to the next generation, into a phenotype. And that also has to be done with high accuracy, high fidelity. So I don't ask the question, how did life evolve? I ask the question, how did evolution evolve? How did we end up with evolution in early life? And I think that's the most critical question in biology. I can't answer that question, but what I'm interested in is a related question, a more mechanistic question, and it's something I've actually been working on, and that is related to the continuity principle in evolution. And what is the continuity principle? This is a quote from Eugene Koonin in one of his papers. It's simply gradualism. Darwin originally talked about this as gradualism, that during evolution, every step must be small, consecutive, manageable steps, each one of which shows a demonstrable increase in fitness. That's the continuity principle. Now, it's usually true in most examples we look at, but more and more examples have been found in evolutionary theory and evolutionary biology that violate that. And one of the most famous, of course, is endosymbiosis, the origin of eukaryotes, which was not a gradual process, but a very sudden change in a prokaryote picking up what later became mitochondria to become eukaryotes. We know that in the origin of vertebrates, there was a very rare, very dramatic event, a whole genome duplication, which allowed for many changes very rapidly in the body plan and in the general phenotype and function of vertebrates. And of course, the Cambrian explosion is quite famous for probably a fairly dramatic, rapid change. So my interest is in, what about replication fidelity? How did that evolve? Did that evolve continually, gradually, small steps? So we may have started with a fairly low level of replication fidelity, then got a little better, and then got a little better, and eventually we have what we have today, which is 99.99999% fidelity. There it is. Because we know humans, animals, all the way down to bacteria, I don't know if I have exactly the right number of decimals, but there's a lot of 0.9s in there. That's pretty remarkable. It can't be 100% or we wouldn't have evolution, because we need to have some variation, but it's incredibly accurate. How do we get that accuracy? Well, first of all, it's been proposed and by several people, and there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, the minimal error rate that we can have in these processes is 1 over L, where L is the length of the genome. Now, you know, Larry mentioned RNA world, which is a fascinating idea and probably right, but the smallest ribozyme, and that's really stretching it, is 50 bases. So the minimum level of error, of fidelity that you could have in RNA replication would be 98%. And that's tough to get 98% fidelity, 2% error in this kind of thing. It involves, and what we know in modern systems is that there are very complex error correction systems that involve many enzymes, DNA repair, all the processes that go on to make sure translation is accurate is really incredible. And there's no way that early proto-life could have had those systems already in place. So that leads to the question, how did the evolutionary system evolve before evolution as we know it could even exist? It sounds a little bit like irreducible complexity, but it probably isn't. There are a number of ideas. I don't have time to go through any of them. But all of them involve starting with a low initial replication accuracy. So what I wanted to do was ask the question, could the evolution of replication fidelity from a lower level to a higher level, could that have followed the continuity principle? Was it a gradual, continual, slow process? And I address this question, because of time, I can't go into any of the details, you can ask me later, of how this was done. It was this was in silico, using a statistical model. And I made some assumptions doing these, doing this work. First, that we start with a low of initial fitness. By low, I mean, you know, not 100% fit, so that there's some possibility of early protocells dying before they can reproduce, which is reasonable assumption. And that these cells divide, once they divided, they had various degrees of replication fidelity. And I made no assumptions whatever about the chemical nature of the information. So this could be DNA world, RNA world, or any other world, because this is only a statistical model. It has nothing to do with biochemistry or chemistry. And the question was simply, if you have a certain initial fitness and a certain replication fidelity, and you artificially make these cells divide, and you can then measure growth rates of the population. And that's all done, you know, by the program. And what we see is that depending on the initial conditions, we find out that there is, at any particular initial fitness that we choose, and this is one particular level of initial fitness, whether or not the cell population will continue to grow and then have a chance to evolve, or whether it will start to go extinct, depends on the replication fidelity. And if you look at the bottom, you see the various curves show replication fidelities. And if you look at that second line from the top, the red line, that's 83% fidelity in this case. Anything below that, the cell population crashes, and there's no evolution possible. So if you're starting with 90%, fine, but if you're starting with 50% a replication fidelity, there's nothing's going to happen. And this is just one example of a lot of the data, but what I really wanted to do was address the issue. This kind of looks like it's saying that continuity is not going to work, but it's not a direct test. So I kind of tweaked this model, and I looked at a direct measurement of continuity, and specifically in this case, discontinuity, the opposite of continuity. And what was very interesting, and this is for whether or not replication fidelity is a direct test of whether replication fidelity is a continuous or discontinuous process, and it turns out it depends on the initial fitness of the cells. So if you look at this curve, DM is a measure of discontinuity. And if you look at the value of, that's what the P stands for, is the initial fitness. If the fitness is very high, then this could be a continuous process, okay? The discontinuity is very close to zero. It's actually the minimum value. But if you're starting with a lower fitness, and you see the shape of the curve is not linear, obviously, but as you lower the initial fitness of the cells, the discontinuity increases drastically to the point where if you have a very low original fitness of 0.1, that's like 10% chance of survival, the discontinuity is such that you need a huge jump in replication fidelity, a saltation effect basically, in order to see any possibility of evolution. So the answer to the question is, in relatively modern life, which is highly fit, you can get increases in replication fidelity, and that's why we have 99.9999% now. But in early life, where we would assume that the initial fitness is somewhat lower, maybe very low, it's not going to be a continuous process to get replication fidelity. There's going to have to be the kind of, one could say, miraculous, I could say it in this audience, I wouldn't say it in other audiences, or some other way that we get a sudden, large, dramatic increase in replication fidelity. So, what's the conclusion of this? From the work I've done so far, and by the way, this work is actually, I submitted a paper on it. I have no idea how it'll go, so I'm not going to go into any more detail on it. But we can conclude that there are thresholds for the minimal survival the fitness, so to speak, and replication fidelity for cell population growth and continuation of the cell population. But below those thresholds, okay, very clear thresholds, there's no such thing as evolution can't occur because the cell population simply dies out. So you could think of this in a whole nother way, less quantitative, and that is, let's say, again, back to that bird who got a mutation which improves eyesight and the bird sees better, and the bird now passes down its DNA to its offspring. If that mutation is not passed down correctly, okay, the offspring do not inherit, and there's no evolution, there's no natural selection. Or if the translation system is faulty, the same effect. If you don't have very high accuracy, and the actual degree of accuracy we can quantitate based on the fitness, if you don't have that kind of accuracy, there's no evolution possible. So I'm saying basically at minimum that there is a discontinuity or a saltation event that is required for evolution, for replication fitness and therefore evolution to have occurred in early cellular evolution. So then the final conclusion is, there's no question in my mind that evolution is the designer of life's diversity. But the question is, how did evolution itself, how is that designed? And that remains an open question. And I'd just like to thank the Templeton Foundation for funding this, and my wife, Aniko Albert, who helped and also was the model for that. So
thank you very much. Well,
Cy, you made a self-fulfilling prophecy by coming in at under 20 minutes. So you do have more time for questions. Go ahead.
Oh, goody. No, I love questions. Yeah, any questions? Yes, sir.
I have two questions. Going back to that slide where at 90% you started going up.
Yeah.
What if you were at 99.99999, which is human?
Oh, okay. So that slide is actually... You mean this slide? The one before it. Okay. At 99... Well, at anything over 83%, you will get growth curve increase. If you are at 100% fidelity, or 99.999, you'll get a curve that has a slope of 2. In other words, the cell population doubles, which is what we see now in typical single-cell organisms. We assume that bacteria have a growth rate of 2. All right, so every cell divides in 2, and both those cells survive, and you have a double. That's what we call these doubling, cell doubling times, because we assume that cells double. But I'm assuming that in early life, you didn't necessarily get a value of 2 for that constant, because a lot of these protocells probably just disappeared at some point through, processes that they were not able to control. Dr. Shirley.
I'd like for you to address, I'll call it a population sedentary with that slide. Right? So as you delivered it to us, you say there will be no evolution from the perspective of an individual that has a given fitness and a given replication rate. But if you look at that slide, that's evolution. Right? Because if you have a mixture of individuals that have these differences,
right,
the ones that have the right combination keep going and the other ones die out.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, what I have not yet done, and I want to, is change this model. These are unitonic or monotonic populations where every cell in the population, I just use 500 cells, has exactly the same initial fitness and exactly the same initial replication fidelity. But what if you have a mixture? Yes. And that needs to be done because that's probably what happened. So this is an early stage, and it's just looking at, okay, what if initial fitness and initial fidelity were very low? Will any cell escape that? And I actually did that study, and that if they're really low enough, the answer is no. There's just, even if you, whatever cell number you choose, none will ever get there. But as you change the diversity of the initial conditions and as you increase the cell numbers, yes, what you're saying is probably exactly what happened. Right. Arnold.
Well, I have two questions. One is a clarification. You said there's a, the minimal allowable error rate is 1 over L, where L is the length of the genome.
Right.
What did you really mean by that minimum for what?
And the functional genome. In other words,
so in order for a genome to remain functional, the minimum allowable error rate is 1 over 11, so 1 over L.
Yeah.
But if it was 10 over L, that's beyond the minimum, so that's okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so.
But that's the minimum. In other words, so. As I said, for a ribozyme, which is maybe 50 bases, 1 over 50 is 0.02. So that's the maximum error rate.
The maximum error rate.
The maximum error rate, the minimum fidelity error rate, because fidelity is 1 minus
error.
Okay,
so error. I think there was a word that might have...
I might have used the wrong word. I tend to do
and
that.
And then related, maybe, you said that now the evolution replication is 99.69%. Is that across species, or is there...
It's across... It's somewhat lower in bacteria than in mammals, but it's across all mammalian animal species. It's pretty much exactly the same. The mutation rate is very similar among, you know, all species as well. So, and in fact... It's interesting because if you look, there's a table that shows the mutation rate and the genome length, and there are only a couple of examples where it doesn't follow the 1 over L, where the mutation rate is actually seems to be too high, and those examples are all in viruses. And it's not understood, except we do know that viruses are extremely weird. So it you know, that's the biological scientific definition.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I heard you say there had to be an error rate with the DNA, and it has to be a mutation to have evolution to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
Is it not possible to have a perfect fidelity in DNA, in other words, 100%, no mutations, it's still an evolution because of the translation process? You don't read the message. In other words, you get a muddled message.
So yeah, I see what you're saying. So if the translation or transcription is error prone, you could still end up with variation in the phenotype. So you're absolutely right. But I will say that when I said 100%, I was referring to all three processes as one. Not simply at the DNA level.
Right.
The fact is, what we know is that every one of those processes has some very, very small error rate. The error rate for DNA replication is actually much lower than the rate for translation. I believe, someone can correct me if I got this wrong, but I believe the error rate for translation is 0.0001. And that's remarkable considering what the translation process involves.
The error rate in the production of proteins is about 40% efficient. There's many more errors than corrections, than correct protein production. So they have to be recycled to try again.
I don't think it's 40%.
It's very low. No, I'm saying it's a high rate of proteins don't fold right. You have the right code, but they don't fold correctly.
Okay,
they don't fold, then they don't have the function.
That's new to me, so you'll have to show me some references. That's interesting.
Why don't we take one more question, and of course there will be time as you leave for lunch to have other questions.
There are two surprises. One is how small the error rate is. The other is, to me as a chemist, is how teeny tiny adaptive benefits can add up over a long time. And I wonder if those can be switched and if beneficial changes came in big chunks, always came in big chunks, but you could tolerate a much slower fidelity. Maybe that's just exactly your point in the next graph.
Mm.
But and I also wonder if, like, in an RNA world where the numbers are much smaller, if that would be a more likely situation.
Right. So to answer the first part, there's a misconception in evolution that what happens is you get a beneficial mutation and so the animal does better. That's not really what happens in evolution. What happens in evolution is you keep getting mutations which are, if they don't kill you, they stay. And So what happens is you get animals with a lot of variation in genotype. And sometimes those include variations in phenotype. And a mutation could occur at time zero, and 5 million years later, the planet changes, and all of a sudden, it's better to have slightly longer hair. And so it's not, so those mutations do accumulate. And so when you see natural selection occurring, it's not because a mutation just happened. It's because a mutation happened a long time ago, got fixed in the population, maybe not even, maybe only fixed in a small part of the population, but all of a sudden now that population becomes more fit. Repeat the second part, because I wasn't sure.
I just wondered if the numbers were much smaller,
yeah,
if you would have larger changes.
Oh, that's interesting.
And,
I have to think.
And then, therefore, could maybe tolerate a lower fidelity.
I have to think about that. That's possible, but it wouldn't affect my own results because these are small numbers. But in reality, that could be true. That would be worth looking into. Yeah.
So let's thank Cy again. And not to be redundant, but let's thank